Welcome to Community Conversations with Louisville Pride. This is part of our Digital Pride initiative. Digital Pride is made possible with support from Republic Bank, Norton Healthcare, Connolly Law Offices, Caperton Realty, and Heine Brothers Coffee. The Community Conversations series is tackling a number of issues related to COVID-19 and LGBTQ issues. And today we're talking about homelessness and specifically homelessness in the LGBTQ population. My guest is Dr. Maurice Gaddis, who is an associate professor of social work at the University of Louisville Kent School. But you're not quarantining in Louisville, correct, Dr. Gaddis?
That's correct. I'm currently quarantining in Richmond, Virginia. I'm a visiting scholar in LGBTQIA+ identities at the VCU School of Social Work in Richmond, Virginia.
Well, I hope everything's going well in Virginia, and we're looking forward to getting you back here in Louisville in the next few months, or I don't know how long your tenure is over there.
Through the summer.
Yes. Well, so to start off with, roughly speaking, how many LGBT youth and adults are homeless, or what portion of the homeless population identifies as LGBTQ?
Yes. So thanks for the question. Thanks for having me. So we have some rough estimates, some national estimates based on sort of pooled data sets. And it's estimated that approximately 20 to 40% of youth living on the streets are LGBT identified. And again, we don't have national, the census doesn't collect this data. We don't have nationally representative data that explicitly asks the question. So again, that's the best estimate. And also we do know that homelessness is cyclical, right? And so we know that point in time estimates give us one night, but we know that people are homeless multiple times, and we want more longitudinal data. So those are the best case estimates.
Has any sort of study like that been done in Louisville to see if those numbers hold true for us as well?
So in about 2018, some colleagues and myself at the University of Louisville published a study that looked at sex trafficking among youth experiencing homelessness in Louisville. The study was not designed specifically to look at LGBT homelessness, but of that sample, approximately 25% were LGBT identified, so that does fit that 20 to 40% range. But again, it was not designed to be representative of homeless youth in the city, so we can't sort of generalize to that. But again, that is another sample of youth experiencing homelessness where there is a representation, because LGBT youth are not 25% of the population.
So that's a massive disparity if LGBT youth or adults are making up 25 or up to 40% of the homeless population. What are some of the reasons for that disparity?
Yeah, so some of the data suggests, so both empirical data that has been peer-reviewed as well as interaction with service providers and anecdotal evidence does suggest that parental dissatisfaction with or disapproval of sexual orientation or gender identity and expression is one of the pieces. So sometimes being led to be kicked out or running away from a situation whereby individuals are not being affirmed. And also we know that many of the estimates talk about like actual street youth homelessness, not sheltered youth. And so often youth do not enter shelters because they don't feel safe, they aren't affirmed, they may have to sleep in a space that's not in line with how they identify their gender. I've worked with transgender youth who say, you know, they camped, they knew not to go receive services, so they would camp out. So this piece of overrepresentation on the actual streets may be due to A, not having a safe home, but also then not having positive experiences with service provision in shelters. And then in some cases, in many cities, there are not even youth shelters to begin with, to even have a place to go, or they are limited in capacity, and many times there aren't suitable numbers to actually host people.
So homelessness does it exist on a spectrum much like LGBTQ identity, where we have this idea of people on the streets, but that's only one type of homelessness?
Absolutely. So homelessness represents, there are different definitions of homelessness. Department of Education has a definition, HUD has a definition, right? Some sort of doubled up, living on the streets, not having a place to live that's meant for human habitation, perhaps being in a tenuously housed situation whereby you may know that in a few weeks you may not have a place to live due to a relationship. So there are a variety of ways in which homelessness is counted and defined as well. And then there are some youth who actually are experiencing a precarious housing situation, and if you ask them if they are homeless, they may tell you no. But when you begin to ask questions like, do you have a place to go consistently for the next week? The answers then they reveal themselves with, you may realize that they may be homeless according to a particular definition. And also the idea of experiencing homelessness or identifying with, there has been some evidence, particularly in the study in San Francisco, that suggests that there are racial differences between identifying as homeless, with white youth being more likely to identify as homeless, where African-American black youth may not necessarily identify with that identity marker, even though actually having the experience.
So people of different racial backgrounds could be in the same sort of precarious housing living situation, but identify it differently?
Yes, there's a study in San Francisco that did suggest that. I don't want to overstate that, but there's evidence to suggest that.
So tell me a little bit about Sweet Evening Breeze and what you all are doing to help with this problem.
So yes, we've been working, as you know, Sweet Evening Breeze has been working in the community, beginning to get our groundwork laid out. We are currently in the process of hiring an executive director. The executive director should be in place next month. We are in the process of interviewing. We received a grant from the Jewish Heritage Fund for Excellence that is specifically funding this position, so we're very excited about it. And with that, we have a strategic plan. We're ready to move forward, and we're beginning to, we're sort of tentatively saying that we'll probably have services up within 3 to 6 months. We are, again, continuing to be nimble, think about the current experiences, think about different models, and with the executive director in place, that will really be more fully formed, really more, and we can solidify that and sort of move full steam ahead.
I guess opening a homeless shelter is a pretty complicated endeavor, right? It's not just like, oh, let's, you know, get a building and slap a sign on it.
Absolutely, right? It is in terms of just thinking about homeless services in general, then thinking about the idea of a shelter, thinking about LGBT affirming, what does that mean? And then thinking about what does it mean in an environment that is ever changing and is a building, housing a large number of people actually in the best interest from a public health point of view, like a shelter? Is it perhaps scattered housing models? Is it smaller spaces throughout the community? So it is a really thinking about taking a deliberate and thoughtful approach that will work well with our population. And also we're working in conjunction with the 550 Clinic at U of L to begin to think about a host homes program, which will also be a way to allow youth experiencing housing instability to have a place to stay in the absence of an actual building or shelter. So just thinking about ways in which we can help youth who are experiencing housing instability thrive and sustain themselves, particularly in a way that's LGBT affirming.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the Host Homes program and how does that work? And then how do you make sure that that's safe for both the person providing the housing and the person coming into a stranger's home?
Absolutely. So I can talk about Host Homes as a model, and then we can talk more specifically about your second question. So Host Homes is sort of an emerging national model that it exists in several cities across the United States, including Richmond, Virginia. There's one in Cincinnati, Ohio, and there are others. And it allows for individual families who have extra space. There are some requirements who have extra space in their home to be matched with a youth who's experiencing homelessness over a certain period of time. And this model, it requires extensive training for the hosts, and as well as a screening process and a matching process to talk about compatibility, to talk about different issues, concerns, living styles, living situations. And it is, you know, there has been ample evidence to suggest that it's a prominent possible model. And so with that, it does allow for capacity for individuals to have places to sleep in the absence of perhaps shelter beds, in the absence of a space to live. It can increase capacity to house people without having physical space. Now, in terms of the safety question, that is a question that Host Homes are thinking about. It's a question that many people are thinking about, questions that Sweet Degrees are thinking about. And it's really will work in conjunction with public health experts, looking at CDC guidelines, and thinking about, is it safe, right? The questions are people tested? What does that mean? We see some of the antibody tests, some of them are false positives. We're still, the country's still trying to figure that out. So I don't want to pretend that there's an answer to that question, right? It's still this idea of navigating, and how do we navigate that? You know, like I said, here in Virginia, we're still under lockdown, right? So the idea of a stranger entering the house and living with someone who may or may not be positive COVID, may or may not be exhibiting symptoms. And if it, in fact, say, let's say hypothetically, a whole situation went through where everyone was tested, quarantined 14 days, entered, then how long does that relationship have to last, right? And so there are a lot of questions that still remain. So I don't want to pretend that there is an answer for how we do this safely. But I do want to say that that is a model, and guidelines and experts would be consistently consulted on that.
Are you able to talk a little bit more about how COVID-19 is impacting housing and sheltering homeless youth? I know you're not on the front lines as a provider, but I mean, it's obviously a big challenge because you're talking about a very vulnerable population, a very at-risk population, and homeless shelters are not set up for social distancing, you know, so do you make them small, do you make them spaced further apart where you can house fewer people, or, you know, how do you deal with that?
Yes, that's a really complex question, and I am a part of the Way Home America Grand Challenge to End Youth Homelessness, centering the lives of LGBT youth of color. I actually have a call with them at noon. And COVID, the impact is still being grasped, right? There are a lot of questions. And I will say before getting into COVID, the reality is before COVID, the challenges for youth experiencing homelessness were great. Right, and it was a really profound. Our systems still weren't equipped, particularly for LGBT. Right, so thinking about all of those situations, access to not having access to housing, not having access to water, not having income to purchase additional supplies that are needed. Right, so with that being the situation before, then add a situation where it's a public health crisis globally, where one of the first things that's happening is people put us under stay-at-home orders, right? So many of the interventions that happen make an assumption that you have housing. If you are youth on the streets or in shelter and you don't have a house, stay-at-home really isn't relevant. Where is home to stay? Wash your hands. You don't have a place to stay, washing your hands. Where do you wash your hands, right? So just some of the groundwork for public health, you know, purchase a mask that requires extra perhaps disposable income. Buy groceries for 2 weeks when you don't have money to buy groceries for a day, right? So all of that all of the risk pre-COVID is exacerbated, right? Thinking about policing, if you're not able to shelter in place and you're violating the orders, you don't have a place to live. So having said that, the CARES Act does provide federal funds to districts and cities to enhance emergency shelter services, housing services, rental assistance for individuals experiencing homelessness, hotel vouchers, and other assistance. And at the same time, everything that I've mentioned is still very much at play, right? Some youth that I've worked with and work with both in collegial manner as well, because I do work with youth experiencing homelessness as my colleague. Sort of the idea of still needing to be able to access things that they needed before COVID, right? Some say I need to access my medication, but the doctors have changed the sort of some of the priorities have shifted, everything with COVID, but I still need what I needed before COVID. And so that idea of not being able to access those services is a concern. And different cities have different protocol in place, right? In terms of some cities don't allow their street out workers to go out to the street, right? So then that, how do people get information? So I know that some street workers, outreach workers are doing like Instagram sort of pieces that they're sort of posting information. And again, that requires having access to a smartphone and digital technology and the internet. So it is making things more complicated. And then there, like I mentioned, there are people who are receiving vouchers. There are some questions around who are prioritized for vouchers. So there's still some questions. And again, when the homelessness response system in many is not robust enough to accommodate youth experiencing homelessness pre-COVID, then you can imagine how this is exacerbated. Because even now, people who are housed are having difficulties, right, accessing food and accessing other services, products. So that's complicated by the fact that pre-COVID, people don't have these things. And some of the public health assumptions are assumed that people are housed. Stay home. You know, when you're sick, stay home from work. Stay home. Well, when you're sick and you're sleeping on the streets, stay home means stay on the streets.
I think this whole situation is revealing a lot of the stress lines and fractures in our society overall that are bad enough under normal times. You know, there's a lot of people who are getting left behind in quote unquote normal times. And now that we're in this crisis, it's just the gaps become even wider and more people are falling through. I've got a couple specific questions about housing and sheltering LGBTQ youth. Specifically, first off, is it a better model or why is it the preferred model to have one shelter rather than to say we're going to work with existing shelters to make sure that they become LGBTQ affirming?
So I've seen across the country a variety of methods. I don't want to create a hierarchy. The idea is that many times what I've seen is, you know, location matters, locales matter. I've worked with organizations and they look at, in some ways, what do the youth want, right? In some instances, you'd say, we don't want a shelter that's LGBT educated because people will say that's LGBT shelter and it might be stigmatized. Other cases, you'd say that's what we do want. Some cases say we're gonna do both. We're going to work with existing shelters to make them LGBT affirming and create spaces that are LGBT affirming specifically. Some places don't have youth shelters at all and see that it's overrepresentation and decide that they want LGBT affirming shelter because that is what they see as the greatest need, right? So the idea is there's a space for all of it. The reality is when something doesn't exist, where do you decide to put your resources? And if you center the lives of LGBT youth of color and youth of color, this is a place where it's disproportionately negatively impacted. So why not listen to the voice of and create a space for, and that way by centering the lives, then it actually elevates the lives of all youth existing. Right. If you consider the lives and experiences and need of the most impacted, then the space and spaces perhaps will address the needs and concerns of the most vulnerable, which will then improve the lives of all.
And when we say youth, are you talking, what age range are you talking about there?
So that's an interesting question, right? So youth is defined in a variety. So for when speaking specifically about Sweden and Greece, we're thinking about 18 to 24. But, you know, people are moving that up to 28, 28, and of course below 18 is youth. That comes with a different set of, with unaccompanied minors, that comes with a different set of challenges that need to be addressed. And we understand some of the limitations of what that means as well. So when we say youth, we're thinking age 18 to 24, but recognizing you're absolutely right, youth is operationalized in a variety of factors, including up to 28 years old.
And when you say, you know, centering the lives of LGBT youth and LGBT youth of color, can you give me an example of what that looks like? I mean, that's what it seems, you know, we often say we want to do these things, but how do we actually do them?
Absolutely. So we think about making sure that upon intake, we ask questions about preferred pronouns. We ask questions about sexual orientation. When assigning spaces, housing, allowing people to live in spaces in which are comfortable with the gender that they identify with. If you're doing host home placements, making sure that the host knows preferred pronouns, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, when developing programming, thinking about healthy relationships, making sure that same-sex relationship information is covered. When thinking about if you're going to have sexual activity programming, make sure that it's sex positive and includes same-sex sexual activities and behaviors. And just have, in addition to markers, having staff that are openly out, openly gay, openly queer, openly trans, having an organization from top down, board all the way down, visible representation of queer people, people of color, and embraced and affirmed and discussed. Having transition services for transgender people, and if that's not possible, make sure that you're advocating openly for services. Making sure that when working with community partners, assessing for the partner's affirmation, understanding if partners say they're affirming, in what ways? What does that mean to them that you're not referring people to organizations that may do harm?
So, and my final question is for shelters of either an LGBTQ affirming shelter or also a more mainstream shelter, for lack of a better term, that wants to be welcoming, but, you know, it has limited resources and limited experience with this sort of thing. What can they do to safely house transgender people and non-binary people? You know, we traditionally have divided shelters into men and women for safety reasons. So it's, you know, how do we deal with that with transgender people who may be at any stage of their transition, and especially for non-binary people who are not going to identify with either one of those categories?
Absolutely. So it's not an overnight transition, right? It has to be thoughtfully planned and thoughtfully discussed and planned out. And there has to be safety mechanisms in place for the staff to be trained on it, for making sure that residents understand the spectrum, making sure that physical spaces are able to accommodate. So, you know, to really be thoughtful in that process throughout, it requires planning. And I know that, you know, True Colors United, based in New York City, they have members in DC as well, are really a good resource for thinking about how do you make spaces inclusive. They were really, really committed to LGBTs experiencing homelessness and have sort of expanded that. But they have some guidelines and best practices. But it certainly does require a little more than signs on doors. It does require institutionalized, it requires training, it requires resident training. It requires a culture shift that's very, very important.
Thank you very much for joining me today to talk about this very important set of issues. Is there anything else you want to share before we leave?
I would just like to say, you know, thank you for highlighting the issue. It's a very important issue. And it will probably continue to be more important and possibly more important as we're seeing the economic situation that's happening. And so in thinking about the future, it's just really going to need intense resources and attention.
Well, thank you, Dr. Gaddis, for joining us today to talk about youth homelessness, LGBTQ homelessness, and Sweet Evening Breeze, the homeless shelter project in Louisville that is working to help solve these issues and is certainly in need of volunteers and donors to support it. This has been Community Conversations. We want to thank the people that make Digital Pride possible: Republic Bank, Norton Healthcare, Heine Brothers Coffee, Connolly Law Offices, and Caperton Realty. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.